these things ever. Okay, so I'm going to be talking about this. Okay, yeah, so I'm going to be talking about preferred branch structure. You know, I'm going to be coming at this from kind of a... Man. We'll see. From kind of a... right, I care about branches in many body wave functions for like quantum foundations reasons. I think that this is a super big important problem that nobody cares about, but they should. But I'm going to be trying to hopefully get you guys excited about how maybe kinetic matter folks should care about it, and in particular, if you want to simulate big many-body systems, in particular non-stationary ones with quasi-classical behavior, then that this is kind of the thing that you should do in order to be able to simulate those efficiently. But I don't really know anything at all about that stuff, so I'm going to kind of tell you as much as I know and thought about it, and you can just tell me if it's totally hopeless, but hopefully it'll at least be interesting. Okay, so the idea, right, is that simulating an arbitrary quantum system exponentially harder than the corresponding classical system where it's exponential in the system size. But with basically zero exceptions, all the real world systems appear classical on large scales, yet are fundamentally quantum, we think. So at some point, kind of in order to do a good enough simulation, the scaling with the system size has to switch over from quantum to classical, at least for all the observables that we care about. So the question is, how do we explain that formally and universally rather than just for some sort of a particular model? And so the first like really simple toy picture I want you to consider is just two particles elastically scattering from each other. So these are their wave functions. And say they interact through some potential that's just the distance between them. Okay? If you transform into the center of mass frame, right, this looks just like a single particle scattering from some potential. So maybe the potential looks like this. Okay? And in one dimension, there's basically two different outcomes you can get, right? You can either tunnel through the potential or you can be reflected off the potential. And if you switch back to the two particle frame, the form of the wave function looks something like this. You've got psi n cross psi n 2, and then under whatever the unitary evolution is, you have out reflected 1, out reflected 2, plus the other option. Okay, and these correspond really intuitively to just the thing where they bounce off of each other, or where they just pass through each other, spatially. Okay. Now, if those particles go on and interact with other things, the form of the state that you're going to get is going to be something like this. And then just all of that for the transmitted, okay? Where these are maybe a bunch of other pieces in whatever lattice that these excitations are moving along. And it's this sort of structure, this kind of GHZ-like structure, where you know psi 1, the psi R1 and psi T1 are orthogonal, and it's orthogonal in many kind of places. This is the sort of structure that I'm going to pull out, or that I'm going to be hoping to pull out at the end. Yeah.
Why would it have this structure for three particles? Why won't there be any RRT or RTR?
Yeah, so I actually don't mean three particles. I literally just mean two particles, but just imagine these excitations, they go, you know, they collide, so they either pass through each other, they transmit, and then they go on and interact with other stuff. Right? And they affect different systems as so they propagate away from each other, but then they go on and affect other things in the system. That's all I mean.
Okay. Okay, but why should it have this structure? Why should only psi 3 r come with psi 1 r and psi 2 r?
Not sure what you mean. So, if the excitation is something there can definitely be some residual entanglement. What I just mean is that that you can make, and I'll make this all precise, but that you can make, in principle, you could make a measurement at different places far from the scattering interaction and infer which event took place. So that if it interacts with a bunch of stuff over there, that there's kind of many records of that occurring.
Jess, are you assuming that loading 1 and 2 interact and then you're not interacting with everything else?
Just that these interactions happen afterwards. This is just really some motivational stuff. If you don't believe me, then wait till I get to something more complicated. I'll have to rely on the foundational motivation, and this won't be as interesting to you guys. But the idea is that, right, whenever we run a quantum experiment, the fact that anything got amplified and that the measurement occurred, almost by definition means that there's a bunch of different records out. So if we run a Stern-Gerlach experiment in the room, there are many localized quantum systems that you could measure and infer the outcome of that experiment. In particular, if you have the readout material, you've got the photons that the screen emits, you've got all the neurons in our brain. If we talk about the outcome of the record, there's the atoms in the room that are us talking about it. So there's many places where you can infer what happened.
And all of that is in psi 3R, right? All psi 3.
Psi 3R, psi 4R, yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, so in general, these will be complicated, but what I'm going to try to get at is the fact that there's kind of multiple places where these two branches, and I'm going to call them branches, where these two branches are locally orthogonal. Okay. I'm trying to think if I could. Okay, and why might this be interesting if you're trying to simulate a system where, for the sake of argument, where something like this happens? All right, so if you look at something like a tensor network representation, I guess this is just a matrix product state. So these are, say this is some computational basis. Drawing here, but let me just finish it for the sake. Okay. So here, right, the interpretation of these summations here, or the bonds, is more or less that they're kind of enumerating the Schmidt decomposition when you make a division in the system across the two halves. Most states, of course, in Hilbert space, if you try to write them down like this, like a Haar typical state, you can't do this efficiently. And what that really means is that these bond dimensions just get really big, right? They become something like the dimension of the system, or the dimension on either half of the system, the smallest one of those. And so to say that you have something that you can efficiently represent in a tensor network is really to say that you have not very much long-range entanglement where long range is defined kind of with respect to the lattice, right? That you can have lots of little bits of short range entanglement, but when you have information that gets spread widely in the lattice, this ups your bond dimension, right? Okay, so this is okay if you are working in the ground state of kind of a reasonable local Hamiltonian, or if you're near the ground state, you just have a few local excitations, because then most or all of your entanglement really is short range. But I'm going to claim And this is just intuition, you can believe it or not believe it, that kind of non-stationary and especially quasi-classical dynamics are going to just very quickly generate long-range entanglement. And this is the kind of picture where I have for that happening. But again, you can kind of appeal to any time that somebody makes a measurement, there's this instant creation of lots of records. And when somebody talks about that and those kind of inferences propagate, suddenly you've got this huge buildup of long-range entanglement, which instantly kills your ability to have an efficient tensor network simulation or representation of that. So my vague goal, or at least the one when I try to, if I wanted to convince somebody with a condensed matter bent of what I'm doing, is I want to kind of, well, actually, one more thing I'll say, right, is that, that's fine. That when you put in, say, a Bell pair, or really some sort of roughly GHZ-like entanglement, if I put in one more bit of information there, then it's going to up all the bond dimensions, right? By like, if I take the same state, but then I just place a pair of entangled particles on either side, it's going to double the number of or double the bond dimension, right? You do that a lot, and it gets very bad. So roughly, what I'm doing is I want to try to find this sort of entanglement and coordinate off. So you can think about that somewhat kind of like a global bond. That the branches in the wave function are going to be the things that you sum over here that is not local, that refers to information that's widely spread and can't be well represented locally. Okay. So then, let's say, goal. By unique, and unique is important for me from the kind of the quantum foundations perspective. Okay, so besides what I've said, kind of what do we think about intuitively when we say branches? We have some sort of Everett kind of picture. Well, we think that the branches should be macroscopically distinct. You shouldn't be able, by performing local measurements, to tell the difference between that state or the corresponding incoherent mixture. Right, this is kind of the operational meaning of collapse. You can't do any local measurements to tell the difference. Although in principle, these are of course distinct, and if you could do a global measurement, you'd be able to tell the difference. As I argued for earlier, we expect there to be redundant information or redundant correlations in the states, in the sense that you can make records at different places and have them all line up. And in particular, those are local records, make local measurements. And we also expect these different branches to be eigenstates of some sort of preferred observables, totally not unspecified, perhaps of preferred systems or preferred degrees of freedom of the system, and maybe other things. And so the problem, of course, is that this is all vague. And what I would really like is to try to find a rigorous definition of branches that you can then go out and prove things about and calculate. Okay. In particular, I'd like to do this in a way to find this decomposition in a way that is basically very different than almost all the discussion of branches that you'll ever find amongst people who care about the measurement problem, where they've got very special situations and there's special degrees of freedom that are kind of unexplained, and it doesn't look like those would apply everywhere in the universe. It's clear that if we just have some state and we're trying to find a decomposition like this, we need to assume some sort of other structure in the world. Without some sort of other structure, this is each one of these, all states in Hilbert space are the same, so we need some sort of other structure. So the question is what could be fundamental enough? What kind of structure could we assume? What's the minimal structure we could assume and still find a unique or essentially unique decomposition like this that satisfies those criteria, those intuitive criteria I talked about before. So the one I think is good is just spatial locality. And so by that, I just mean some sort of decomposition of the Hilbert space into local chunks where you can take these to be microscopic. So in some sense, right, I've identified preferred systems, but they're really not, because these could just be individual qubits or something like this, or there's a way to talk about this all sensibly in field theory, so these could literally just be arbitrarily small regions in space. And the thing about, of course, you introduce this tensor structure is that now any given state is going to have all sorts of multipartite entanglement that you can define based off of this tensor structure. And I'm going to hope that that is enough to say a lot. Okay, and so the major intuition is this redundant information. Okay, so how do we define this? What I wanted to be able to say, like we were talking about before, is that you can make measurements at different places and kind of identify which branch you're on. Or another way to say it is that the branches are locally orthogonal, that you can check the difference between the branch by just making a local measurement. But of course, if we want to try to be as agnostic as possible, and these are all just qubits, we can't make truly local measurements in the sense of measuring just one lattice site, because then you would only be able to, there'd only be one kind of bit. You'd only be able to have two branches. So we want to allow for measurements on regions of the lattice, but we don't want to specify or prefer any regions a priori. So I'm going to proceed like this. So I'm just going to use the symbol F both to refer to the kind of subsystem formed by pulling together a bunch of lattice sites and literally the subset of N that labels them. And I'm going to use the over bar there to just refer to everything else. Then any observable that's acting only on F has some unique eigendecomposition into degenerate subspaces. It looks like this. Okay. Where in particular, the projector, and I'm going to overload the notation here, has this kind of behavior. So that's just all I mean by an observable on a fragment, on a section of the lattice. Okay, so given that, can I move?
Geometric locality necessarily here, or just?
I'm going to make a reference to geometric locality right at the end. Everything else is going to be literally just, these are distinct things. Distance is not going to matter. I'm going to go. Oh, this is no good. Let's go to the next one. So I'm going to make a definition. Say one observable records another I think I went off the rails a little bit there. That's okay. So, there's kind of two equivalent ways you can write this down. We say that these two observables, one records the other. Well, when you can use their corresponding degenerate subspace, the projectors onto those, and you pull out the same chunk of the wave function. An equivalent way to say that is you consider the projectors onto F prime, right? One of those regions. Trace everything else besides F out, and think about the reduced state on F. Okay. So now you've got I. As a function of I, as a function of the different outcomes. So in the simplest case, you can just think of it as I is equal 1 or 0. It's some bit that's being recorded. And then if you can make a measurement on F, which is to say these two guys are orthogonal, if you can make a measurement and distinguish them for I does not equal J, then they're recorded. And these are all equivalent conditions, and you can, it's easy to check that you can switch F and F prime, and that's all the same. Okay. So this is a symmetric relationship, and in fact, you can just very quickly extend it. So you can imagine pi f double prime, and so on. And actually, this. Okay, so a recorded observable is some set of these local observables on disjoint F, F, F prime, F double prime, that record each other. So on. So I'm using this to define psi I. The psi I are the branches corresponding to this particular observable. Each OF is a record. And the number of records is the redundancy. Okay.
Pi's are all orthogonal, right?
The pi's, well, the pi's on different fragments are they just operate separately.
Pi and I and pi of j, are these orthogonal?
Yes, yeah, because they're this is an observable, right? So it's got some sort of orthogonal decomposition into degenerate eigenspaces. And you'll notice, right, that the definition here doesn't depend at all on this real eigenvalue here. These are literally just labels. And so if you want, you can think about this not really as an observable being recorded so much as some sort of like a subalgebra, local subalgebras recording each other, because it's really these degenerate subspaces that matter. Okay. So the intuition that I'm going to try to push on you is the highly recorded observables, meaning ones where R is large in some sense that we haven't and won't completely define here, ought to be objective in the sense that they correspond to things that either happened one way or didn't happen the other way. And in particular, right, many observers can agree with each other on the various outcomes. Each of us can make a local measurement and come to an inference about which value of I is the correct one. And certainly, this seems like a minimally necessary condition for anything like a measurement to happen, that this kind of amplification is a key step in the measurement process. Okay, so how could we get how does this relate back to the tensor network simulation? Well, the thing is that we can estimate an endpoint function by just sampling the branches. So long as the redundancy R is greater than N. Okay? And we're also, there's going to have to be a requirement, of course, on the variance of this observable over the branches. So just to see that, right? So we're going to calculate some set of local observables. We can, of course, expand this in any basis, including these branches. So now we've got different index I and j here. But the idea is that psi I is a eigenstate of this pi projector, and I can, so long as the redundancy is larger than the n in this endpoint function, I can always find an f that that doesn't overlap with any of these n's, right? If these are all local observables. And so therefore, these commute. It commutes with all of them. Right. So this is just, oh no, that's not a blackboard. Uh-oh. Okay. Forget about that. You get a delta ij, right? And so at the end of the day, this is just some sort of sum over the branches. Okay, but this is just a classical probability distribution. And as long as the variance of this over across the different branches is finite, you can estimate this quantity by just sampling the branches, right? Insofar as your intuition tells you that branching in a quasi-classical system should be continuous, that there, this kind of stuff keeps happening, the number of branches might grow. So far, I've only talked about one, and I'm going to continue to talk about kind of more branching events, more observables in a second. But if we can get away with just randomly sampling the classical branches, then we should be able to estimate all these endpoint functions well. Now, like I said, if the variance is essentially infinite because, you know, this sum is dominated by just a small number of branches, then obviously that doesn't work because then you have to sample enough to have found one of those. But if not, then you can do it. And I think this makes sense that we expect, right, that if we're doing a simulation and there's kind of two very completely distinct outcomes and we're asking just local questions, then it should be enough to assume that one outcome or the other happened, right? Okay. Okay, right, so now the problem is, this is only useful if we've got lots and lots of branches. Presumably this is happening in many places. There's very good reason to believe, supported by a bunch of toy models and intuition and nice situations, that any classically chaotic system is going to, in general, produce these redundant records. So you don't have to rely on your Stern-Gerlach experiment sitting in your basement. You can just have any classically chaotic system is going to constantly be generating these redundant records. And so the question is to what extent are these compatible? Let's see, when did I start? 4:35? Okay. All right, I'm gonna have to start erasing.
Branches, but that's the amount of redundancy is not equivalent to the number of branches.
Right. Yep. So totally distinct numbers. Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Could you have a physical example of what you mean by redundancy?
By redundancy?
Yeah.
So I just draw on like really silly kind of, well, there's two ways. So there's the measurement one. You run an actual measurement in your lab, and then you can copy that information everywhere. In some sense, this is what an amplifier does. Basically, all sorts of measurements, right? They map a quantum basis. You take a quantum system, you decompose it into its eigenstates and some basis, and then you map those onto macroscopically distinct outcomes. What that immediately means is that if you just move a macroscopic object, say the pointer in your experiment, based off of which outcome happens, then there's a record in every single one of those atoms, the little chunks of the atom.
Only copying the classical information, right?
Absolutely, right. So the whole idea is that the classical information is going to be the eyes here. So if I just can runs over two values, that's one classical bit, and that's the only thing that can be made redundant is classical information.
Sorry, can you explain again why you need many branches?
Well, this is only going to be, there's this distinction between a number of branches, I taking a bunch of values, versus multiple branching events, right? So just like you can run multiple experiments in the room, you can have multiple classically chaotic systems. And each of those things is going to be depositing records. And so they're going to correspond to different recorded observables, right? So this is one observable. It's the outcome of some experiment with many different records. But then we're going to need to worry about, and that's just the next thing I'm doing, is multiple recorded observables. So, follow up with me if it's not clear in like a couple minutes.
Yeah, that's my question.
Yeah. Okay, so here, I, J, K, these index different recorded observables, okay? And then to say that each one of these joint branches is a simultaneous eigenstate is just to say that if you grab any of the recorded observables and you select one of their records and you apply it to the branch, right, it's an eigenstate. Or, of course, you could also just put the pi here instead, and then this would just be a delta function. Okay, so that's what I mean by multiple observables all being compatible with each other. Okay, that on each branch, each one of the recorded observables takes a distinct value. And furthermore, you can confirm that value at multiple different places.
Do you need to be concerned about the dynamics of this? Like, you know, it evolves in time and
absolutely. So, yeah, so I'm doing everything at a fixed time based off of just what you kind of hope to apply to anything you would reasonably call branch at a fixed time. And then the question of whether those records persist and for how long is a question I think is really important.
So we're not talking about two observables at different instances of time being compatible with each other.
Nope, these are all one time. Yeah, exactly. All right, and it's not too hard to see that if this is true, then these have to be defined by for an arbitrary, right, so you got a bunch of different IJKs. You pick a projector from each one at random. So which F you choose doesn't matter, which G you choose doesn't matter, just as long as it's from that allowed list. And then you operate them on psi. If this decomposition exists, the order, none of this, the order can matter, which F you choose can't doesn't matter. Okay. And so you have like a very nice interpretation of what that psi is, right? It's just the simultaneous eigenstate of all those observables. That's it. So it seems clear that, or we think, right, that all of the kind of big macroscopic observables in the world, the kind of the Everett branches that we imagine out there should be all simultaneous eigenstates of these big macroscopic observables. The moon's, you know, its position is some macroscopic observable, and it's either in one place or a different place. It's not in multiple places. But this doesn't apply to microscopic observables, right? The world, the wave function of the world doesn't have to be a simultaneous eigenstate of those guys. Okay, so the first thing really quickly to note is that twofold redundancy is clearly not enough to guarantee compatibility. That if you have two different recorded observables that are recorded with twofold redundancy, that's not enough. The belt state shows that. Right, so you can think about the observable 0, 1 that's recorded on each belt pair, and their simultaneous eigenstates of that. At the same time, the observable plus and minus are recorded on each one. But there is no joint decomposition that's a simultaneous eigenstate of all these guys, right? However, interestingly, if you move to the GHZ state, there is only one way to do this. Okay, and that's not too hard to check. And I'm going to quote a more general theorem, but a kind of intermediate step toward that is that if you have any Hilbert space, or I should just say, if all of your projectors act only locally on a single lattice site. So for now, assume the lattice site can be big, just so that things are interesting. But if each projector, each observable is local to just a single lattice site, then having three records is enough for all of the observables to be compatible. Okay? And the jump from two to three is literally just a monogamy of entanglement sort of thing. Okay? But if we don't want to, if we want to allow these sites to be microscopic, and we want to identify these things just by their redundancy, we'd like to, right, if we have some sort of lattice, right, we're going to be making measurements on some sort of subsets of the lattice, right? And this is a much more complicated situation because we might have records for other observables that look like this. Okay.
Sorry, just before you move on to this situation, this thing about, you know, having three records is sufficient
yep.
for compatibility, which that does that assume that I is full rank on a single site? I mean,
Nope. So let's say you had let's say the world is really simple. It's just n lattice sites, and let's say I have four different bits, classical bits that I want to record in here, and for each bit, I can obtain it by making a measurement on at least three different places. I can make a measurement here and then figure out the bit. I can make a measurement here, measurement here. As long as I'm sticking to just one lattice site, then, and this isn't obvious. This is just a kind of a special case of the thing I'm going to say later. All of those have to be compatible. There's a way to write down the state of the whole system in terms of simultaneous eigenstates of every single one of those observables.
Independent of the local Hilbert space dimension.
Well, yes. I mean, the in order for me to be able to read off a bit, if I was reading off two different bits here, if bit A and bit B were both being read off here, then this local Hilbert space has to be at least four dimensional. But other than that, that's the only that yeah. Let me think about how I want to do the order here. Yeah, so I'm just going to state the. I'm going to write down one more definition, and this one's going to be weird, or it's not going to be obvious why we care about this, and then hopefully it'll become clear. We're going to say so some recorded observable. Pair covers another when there exists a pair of records. One together spatially overlap all records of the other. Okay. So let me consider two observables. This is row A, this guy is row B. Okay. Okay, so the idea here is that so these regions represent right subsets of the lattice on which the records are stored. Here you can see that neither of these observables pair covers the other, because there is no couple of records I could pick that would overlap with everything else. Okay, but on this side, I could grab these two, and they of the observable sub A, and they overlap all the records of the other one. Okay. So this is kind of an unusual criterion to consider, but I hope that intuitively, when you think about the many records that are produced in a measurement, or anytime you amplify anything in the real world, it would be very unusual if the records that you make, or rather the regions that you go to infer, to read off those records, were to cover everything else for another observable. In fact, usually everything is just kind of separated around. It'd be fine if two records were on top of each other, of two different observables, but to have every single record for one of them covered by just a couple of the other would be surprising.
Just in your original definition there.
Yep.
It was a phi AF, and it's a phi AF prime, is that right?
Phi, sorry, where?
In the brackets there, phi AF, phi AF prime.
I haven't been calling it phi.
Theta,
oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Say it again.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, so that's, yeah.
It's just.
Yep, good. So, family of many important recorded observables. Okay, so the theorem is that if you have an arbitrarily large family with a bunch of different, each one would of course have a corresponding redundancy, they all will be compatible in this sense, so long as none of them pair covers another one. Right? Remember that pair covering here is a asymmetric binary relationship between recorded observables, so like the outcomes of measurements. And as long as none of them kind of weirdly cover everything else, then they're all compatible together and you have one joint decomposition. Okay. So I think that this seems like a very weak requirement for anything that we would intuitively identify as kind of something that's been recorded in a bunch of places and is classical information. Macroscopic events, right, they leave many records that are fairly well localized. And so therefore, just kind of everything that might be recorded macroscopically in a bunch of different places, you should expect joint branch structure. Okay. What is prohibited by this? The major kind of counterexample that motivates this is that redundancy alone, just having a large number of copies of something, is not enough to ensure compatibility. And the reason is this, or one example that you might consider, is the short code. Okay, so the short code, the kind of easiest way This is just kind of the general one for on a M by M prime lattice. Yeah, that's fine. Okay, so if you can imagine you have a lattice, it's M by M prime, and each one of these, the intersection points here is a qubit, okay? Now you just construct this state. So it's clear here that if you consider like just, right, so for just one term in this tensor exponent would correspond to, let's be tensored together, M prime times, so it's one of these guys. And then there's m qubits, right, in there. And by making a measurement on m qubits, you can infer the difference between this state and that state. It's not too hard to check, and you can infer just by what ends up being the symmetries of this state, that you can do the exact same thing going in the other direction. By making a measurement on the red guys, you're going to infer the spin x information for the code qubit, and by making a measurement on the m prime guys, you can infer spin z information on the code qubit. And so these can't be compatible observables. But the point is that this delicate overlapping structure of the records, which becomes kind of more and more extreme as you consider m and m prime to be large, is totally critical because it's what allows you to avoid this theorem about covering each other, okay? And that if you consider that you're going to have some sort of Avogadro's number of copies of an observable that ought to be considered classical in the world, then anything else that also has that number of copies, they have to be all very kind of long and stringy and unusual. Okay, and then so the last thing, and I'm almost done here. So the nice thing about everything that we've done, kind of criteria that we might imagine for branches, is that it respects all the symmetries of the lattice. And so far you've got rotational symmetry and translational symmetry and all that stuff. You've got a definition at least of what it means to be redundant. That respects all the symmetries of the lattice. By introducing a length scale, I'm basically going to rule out the short code and things like the short code, and show that there's a, given that preferred length scale, there's a single maximal decomposition of the wave function into branches that are redundantly recorded. So it's not going to be ideal because it introduces this preferred length scale, but at least gives you a sense of what you get at the end. So the criteria is just this. And this is the only time I'm using that the distance on the lattice. It's not going to. There's a way to slightly relax this in one direction and make it tighter in the other that depends on the dimensionality of the space. But it doesn't have to, maybe it does, finite dimensional.
You just have the Bolling space bed.
Yeah, I don't even know why that would be. That's the wrong, I'm the wrong guy for that question. Maybe I'll write it down and you could be like, oh yeah. So basically I just mean, I'll just say, okay, so consider just the recorded observables that are recorded in at least three spheres, could be more, but at least three, of that size and separated by that size. The result is just they're all compatible. Okay, and this is literally just because you can't pair cover using observables that are like this, right? If the records are that size, I can't cover all three of those guys, right? That's it. You could, if you wanted to specialize to a specific number of Euclidean dimensions, you could then not require necessarily that they're separated, but you could just say, well, there have to be three to the D or something like that, so that you can't bunch them together such that they overlap, and it basically guarantees that. But same thing, this is the key thing. And so right away, right, if you just take L to be like a foot, then everything that fits in your head and fits in two other people's heads, all that information has to be compatible, right? And so there's, and so there is some, right, way to decompose the wave function of the universe such that all the information that fits in our heads is compatible in that sense. And the nice thing about this, right, is that you can just, you don't have to go around comparing different observables. You can just say, consider all the observables that satisfy this. If I'm running a simulation, I could just find the things that satisfy that. Maybe I can't find the other recorded observables, but I can still kind of find the decomposition corresponding to those guys. And you take your wave function, break it up, just sample based on those branches, and maybe be able to save time by not simulating all the branches. So that was, I had a couple more things, but that was pretty much the last technical results. I'm just gonna close with a couple of comments. Right, okay. So what I'd really like to be able to do is guarantee compatibility without a preferred length scale. I am able to show that you have to make reference to something just beyond the scale and variant properties of the records. That if you just had some property of records that you can't tell the difference between dilating it or contracting it, then there's always a way to construct incompatible records. But you can imagine, rather than pulling that length scale from just declaring it a priori, you can pull that out of the wave function. So anytime you handed me a wave function, I'd be able to extract that length scale from it and then give you back a preferred decomposition. So I would like to be able to find a way to do that. Right, the key idea was this intuition that anything that was a good kind of classical outcome for an experiment or any kind of macroscopic observable, it really seems like redundancy and maybe some sort of weak requirement on the separation of records it's hard to imagine anything that you would intuitively consider an observable that doesn't satisfy that. And so we'd like to be able to just take those intuitions and turn them into a uniqueness result. But one, I don't know one that doesn't make reference to a length scale. So if you have any ideas, I would love to be very interested in that. The short code turns out to be very fragile, right? If you flip any one of those bits, or if you just tweak a little bit, then as m and m prime go to infinity, then just very small adjustments will completely destroy the information. So you can imagine ruling things out based on fragility. Once you have these branches, you can ask what I think are a bunch of really interesting questions, right? So if you have a branch decomposition, right, it just defines an entropy for you, right? Just the entropy of the branch weights. The first question you can ask is, what does this do under time evolution? Does the number of branches go up? Do they go down? From, you know, everything here is at one time slice. You can imagine all the branches kind of, you know, going across some amount of time and not being related to the ones beforehand. So how they relate during time evolution, whether they just proliferate and not collapse, that's something you'd want to show. There's reasons to think that the entropy defined by the branch weights should be equal to the Kolmogorov-Sinai entropy for classically chaotic systems. And I think that'd be very interesting to see. And then finally, in the distant future, you can, what happens when the system thermalizes, basically? A thermal state is, in some sense, just right a Haar random state pulled out of the Hilbert space. And Haar random states don't have redundant information. It's like being inside of an oven. Anything that you do locally tells you nothing about what's going on the other side of the oven. So it's clear that at some point, if branches are being produced, that they have to go away. And so the question is, you know, if you have these number of branches that's increasing, do they eventually decrease? Is that the same thing as heat death? Can that tell you anything about the thermalization of quantum systems? I have no idea. But that's all I had for you. Thanks, guys. Not too long, not too bad. All right. Any questions?
I was going to ask, for my own understanding, I'd like to kind of have an example which, you know, I can place in the categories of condensed matter systems in one or two dimensions or something like that. So,
yep.
I mean, what about topologically ordered systems? So there you have, you know, locally indistinguishable superpositions you can have, you know, put the system in some logical non-trivial state.
Yeah.
Right. Then presumably then the number of, so the redundancy is say the size of the ground space, the ground state subspace.
But if you can't distinguish them locally, then I would think there would be nothing recorded locally, right? So no redundancy zero.
Yeah. Right.
Because they protect against the proliferation of classical information.
This is in some sense like the opposite of, right? The short code is the unusual case, right? The quantum information being protected is the unusual case that is not like how the real world is.
Yeah, no, but I'm not interested in getting at. Let's say I'm not interested in getting at the logical qubit.
Okay.
I'm just interested in some other local details.
Right? Yep.
Then if I do have some, say, global superposition in this sense that I have a logical, non-trivial logical state.
If you have a global superposition in that sense, then you have a non-trivial logical state. Yeah, I think you just have no non-trivial classical branch structure. The branch decomposition would just be trivial. It would just be nothing.
I mean, following up on that, I mean, can you use this formalism maybe to talk about categorizing topological order as like something which prevents the, you know, the branching structure sequence?
I mean, I can certainly see why topologically protected states don't have this structure. I don't know what I can say about it other than that it's not there. I think I can say that this weird overlap structure has to exist, right? But the whole idea of protecting quantum information, right, from local errors is that you. It's got to be, you know, if you have an error over here, you have to be able to infer the qubit, infer the quantum state from over here. But if you have an error there, you have to infer it from here. So that, you know, the more robust you are to a bunch of local errors, it means you have a bunch of records. And what this says is that if you can do that for a quantum, you know, a qubit rather than just a classical bit, that the readout has to be in this funny overlapping way. Does that make sense? Because if it wasn't, then it would then you couldn't get all the quantum information. You'd only be able to get the classical information in some basis.
I have another question. So, matrix product states.
Yeah.
You began with that example. So, I know that you pointed out, I guess, some two matrix product states together, you double the bottom dimension.
Right.
So, are you thinking about I wanted to practically use this to say make my algorithm more efficient. I could look for some possible sum decompositions of my MPS.
Yeah, that's the idea. So you have some state, you have some system that you want to simulate.
Yeah.
Right off the bat, this is not what most people care about simulating, because what this is going to work for is not the ground state. It's not stationary states. It's got to be something with some sort of excitations that are moving around and interacting and have some sort of classical interpretation.
Well, let's say I hit the ground state at a point and I allow excitations to travel out. And maybe I hit it at two different points. I don't know.
Yeah, good.
Things start colliding.
Yeah, good. And that's exactly what I expect, right? So if you can take this collision thing, right, where this is a very nice situation, because then you just have a very clean, just it's kind of an either or example. But if the system is kind of bounded together, or there's many, some finite excitation density, then this just keeps happening, right? And the amount of long range entanglement you expect to grow, right? That's not you have some system, you have a bunch of excitations. As they move around, the system evolves, and the amount of long range entanglement grows. So exactly. So the idea is that you would start out with some sort of matrix product representation of the system, because you have no long range entanglement at the beginning. You have an efficient representation. As it goes on, long range entanglement grows, your simulation becomes intractably slow, unless you can take the state of the entire system and break it up into these branches. Each one has less long-range entanglement. And then the idea is that the number, if this is going to be, presumably this is going to get exponentially harder in time, because, and the intuition is this, because the branching happens continuously. Every second you have a branch. So the number of branches grows exponentially in time. But if you only need to sample those branches, you can just kind of throw them out, right? So that as the simulation goes on, you prune the branches, and you can kind of, for some accuracy that you want to estimate any observable, you never need to keep more than that number of branches to get that accuracy. Now, what that requires is that basically, all the things that is making your simulation slow down have to be captured by this. If your simulation starts slowing down because the whole system thermalizes, then this won't work because you won't find branches in the thermalizing system. Mm. But insofar as the simulation is slowed down by this sort of thing, then you should hopefully be able to speed it up.
But isn't the problem with simulation? It's precisely because system is thermalizing.
Well, so this is what I say. So once the system fully thermalizes, then you know what all local observables look like, right?
The challenge is always how to reach the regime that you go from some pure state to fully thermalized state.
Right. So the pie in the sky vision is that this is that does that. You can track that the number of branches grows and grows, and then the thermalization is when those you can think about it as the branches kind of colliding. This has to happen because the branches have to be orthogonal. In fact, they're orthogonal in a special way, and there certainly can't be more branches than the dimensionality of the Hilbert space, right? So there's the number of branches has to grow in time, and then it kind of has to go down. And I think when it goes down is when it thermalizes. And so you can hope that basically you would start with one branch, you can simulate it efficiently. You have the thermal state, which you can simulate all the local observables efficiently. And that the branches dividing is the part where it gets hard. But if you can keep track of the branches, then you can simulate it efficiently until it starts to thermalize. At which point you just say, well, local observables look thermal. That's really super speculative and unlikely. Really optimistic, I should say.
So there's a lot of thermodynamics, and just it sort of in the literature, there's a kind of sense that like the emergence of classicality, the branching structure is a dynamical property.
Yep.
But this is like a very static property.
And is there a sense in which, like, you can very easily show that over some time scales, the static property is equivalent to the dynamical property of no recoherence of the of these branches? Is that,
yeah, it does. The intuition here is so super vague and sketchy. The idea is if you have many copies of things, right, in order to get recoherence, you kind of have to bring all the copies back together.
Yeah.
Right. In order to, you know, you produce a GHZ state, and then you have to kind of flip everything back together. And it's just the hardness of that, that high redundancy, will make that hard. Right. We know that a redundancy of 3 or 5 or 10 is not enough to ensure true collapse, because we can do superpositions of more than 3 or 5 or 10 particles, right? And so what I really kind of imagine is that you'll have some decomposition into branches at a fixed time, but the branches will have kind of a distance between them that is something like redundancy, but not. So the redundancy is something like the Hamming distance, right? It's like how many things do you have to flip in order to make these two things look the same? I think you're going to want something more like the quantum circuit complexity or something crazy like that to say that kind of thermodynamically it's become intractable to bring these branches back together. But in any case, right, what I imagine is that there's going to be some sort of, you'll have some sort of a distance metric between branches, and then once the branches have separated enough, the chance that they come back together is very small, and that then is when you can kind of collapse it. You can just choose one or the other.
But what do you mean by distance if they are orthogonal?
Yeah, so I there's several distance metrics you can consider. It's certainly not the inner product. So the redundancy, right? So if you have two branches that differ just based on their value for one recorded observable, the redundancy is like the Hamming distance, right? It's like they're, you know, identical everywhere except at each one of the, you know, at every one of these spots. This spins up, that spins up, this spins up, or on the other branch, down, down, down. And you have to flip each one. And just intuitively, like, the larger the Hamming distance, the more separate the branches and the harder to get back together. But for what I was talking about to him, I think Hamming distance is not what you want. But it's kind of...
You want to, like, move through a local operation space.
Yeah.
I think, I don't have any actually concrete comment on that.
We're in the same boat, man.
Nope. If there are no further questions, let's thank Jessica.
Thanks.